I think it's going to be a cold one tonight. So I think we got one more day of this crap.
After a restart in Fairbanks, the Iditarod is underway as mushers battle frigid temperatures. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, hundreds of budget amendments get shot down in the House Finance Committee.
You know, are we really looking at each line and seeing where we can cut, just like they would in their own business or in their own home?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
During the first night of this year's Iditarod, teams endured frigid temperatures on the Tanana River to reach the second checkpoint of Manly Hot Springs. As Alaska Public Media's trail reporter Ben Matheson reports, teams are adjusting to the deep cold and preparing to push to the Yukon River, where the race will unfold.
Nicholas Petit drove far into the night before pausing to rest. In Tuesday's bright afternoon sun, Petit says the long early run on the way to Manly behind past champions Martin Boozer and Mitch Seavey is all part of the plan.
If they're not tired enough to not go 100 miles an hour, they'll get frostbite. There's a reason for my madness.
Other mushers cruise through the checkpoint, choosing to camp further up the trail. Petit says the trail was hard and fast out of Nanana, meaning he needs to watch his speed at this early stage in the race.
They're good enough to where I can tell them what speed to go, and they just go that speed, so that I don't really have to hold them back too much to go 7.5 miles an hour. And if I ask them to, they'll go 12. But we don't need to do that quite yet. Mm-hmm. Then we can go 14 on the way to Nome.
Rick Casillo swapped out dog coats for a different style to keep the males from getting frostbitten. He was breaking his runs into five-hour stretches to manage the cold and keep his string of 16 dogs intact.
I think it's going to be a cold one tonight, so I think we got one more day of this crap.
The forecast calls for milder temperatures after Wednesday. A few parking spots away from Petit, the winner in the last 3 years, Dallas Seavey, was feeding an extra snack before he left the warm sun of Manly Hot Springs. Because dogs burn extra calories in the deep cold, Seavey wanted to load up before the next big run.
Yeah, there's a couple of these guys. I'm going to give them a little snack before we go. Some of these guys are real good about eating snacks on the trail regardless of temperature. And other dogs, they don't like the cold meat so much, you know, and it was 40-something. I think I saw 47 below this morning was the coldest that I saw. So.
Seavey was multitasking, working his way up and down the team, fitting booties and cooking the meal. He's focused on the details that add up during the 1,000-mile race.
One of those mushers' dogs may have gotten 20% more sleep during that time because they were a little more efficient doing the chores and whatnot. So in my theory, if the dogs aren't running, eating, or sleeping, pretty much everything else is wasted time, albeit oftentimes necessary wasted time, like putting booties on.
In the heat of the midday sun, Seavey left with only 11 dogs strung out front, but he had 5 stowed in his new carbon fiber and Kevlar sled. Several past champions left in quick succession Tuesday afternoon. Martin Boozer first, followed by Jeff King, Mitch Seavey, and Dallas Seavey. The trail takes them to Tanana to meet the Yukon River, where the real racing can begin. I'm Ben Matheson in Manly Hot Springs.
We asked climatologist Brian Bretschneider to look into how this year's cold and snow stacks up to weather records for the segment Ask a Climatologist. Bretschneider told Annie Fight the start in Fairbanks was 19 below zero at 11 a.m. yesterday, by far the coldest in Iditarod history.
So even though the low temperature, if you look at the low for the day, it was minus 38, it had warmed up. Using the term warm loosely, it had warmed up to minus 19. And that is, by a wide margin, the coldest start for the Iditarod since they started in 1973.
Is that cold likely to stick around?
It's only supposed to last for a couple of days, and then temperatures should be rising into the 20s, even 30 or so for the high temperature, and then low temperatures in the, you know, single digits, teens. So the extreme cold is a short-term phenomenon.
What about snow? How much is there, and is there any in the forecast?
Plenty of snow on this route. There shouldn't be any major issues with lack of snow.
But none in the forecast.
And none in the forecast. So for the next week, none of the checkpoints along the way are forecasting even a flake of snow. Now, that's subject to change, potentially. But to have no snow, you know, for that long a period for the entire route is really uncommon. Now, March is the driest month of the year for most of Alaska. But only a small number of years during the Iditarod week have actually gone the entire time for that route, not recording any snow at all. So it should help things move along a little faster.
So when we look back at this race, do you think the cold will be notable, or will the cold temps at the beginning and the relatively normal temps at the end kind of even out?
Yeah, that's going to be, you know, how we kind of remember it. I think a lot of people are going to remember how cold it was at the start. But when you average in, like you said, from the beginning to the end, it's going to go down. It's probably a pretty typical race period temperature-wise.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Conflicts over the state budget are rising as the spending plan advances through the House Finance Committee. Committee member Tammy Wilson introduced more than 200 of 330 amendments to the budget, including a group of separate 38 cuts to overtime and other types of work that pay state employees additional money. The North Pole Republican wanted to debate each amendment individually, but the committee combined most of her amendments into two groups, then voted down both. Wilson objected.
Well, it doesn't allow the discussion we owe Alaskans. You know, are we really looking at each line and seeing where we can cut, just like they would in their own business or in their own home? And by adding it all together makes it to where somebody can say, well, I didn't like one or two of them. Well, you know, are you going to throw all the other 90 out because you didn't?
As a form of protest, Wilson read from her amendments for nearly an hour. Wilson says it's particularly important to look to cut the budget at a time when the House is weighing whether to introduce an income tax. Anchorage Democrat Representative Les Guerra argues against cutting much more than the state has already eliminated over the past four fiscal years.
I get the urge to cut the budget even more. It's been cut by over $3.3 billion since FY13. But at some point, you just can't ask for blood from a stone, and you can't make fewer people who are serving Alaskans do more by further cutting their ability to do work.
The committee voted to reverse a vote it took last week to cut school debt reimbursements by nearly $50 million. And it also voted down Wilson's proposal to cut the base student allocation the state pays schools by 5%. The committee is scheduled to discuss the budget more tomorrow and Thursday. Nine people in Houston, just north of Wasilla, have been hospitalized after being exposed to carbon monoxide in a home. One victim in critical condition was flown to Seattle for further treatment. Houston Fire Chief Christian Hartley says the Monday night incident occurred at a home that had a generator running in the basement. Hartley says a resident had left the home because of a headache and went to the home of a friend. He says the two went back to the affected home and dragged the other people out. The incident follows the February carbon monoxide death of an 18-year-old man at an Anchorage home. Fire officials say having carbon monoxide detectors in every room of a home is critical to ensuring people have enough time to get out if there is a spike in the deadly and odorless gas. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bringing diversity into outdoor recreation, one Alaska youth is trying to get others to enjoy Alaska.
I don't want to get rid of these misconceptions that, you know, the outdoors is for a particular audience.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Two U.S. House committees are due to take up the new Republican health care bill tomorrow to replace the Affordable Care Act. When the bill gets to the Senate, Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski could turn out to be a swing vote. She has said she's willing to break with her party to keep Medicaid expansion and funding for Planned Parenthood. But as APRN Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin found out, Murkowski isn't ready to say yet what she makes of the House bill.
In the basement of the U.S. Capitol, a clot of reporters lay in wait for Senator Murkowski. Everybody wanted to know what she thinks of the health care bill. But Murkowski was in a hurry to get on the underground train to get back to her office. A Washington Post reporter lobbed a question as she boarded.
Do you like this bill?
I like the Senate resolution that we just passed.
It Hooray. Had nothing to do with health care.
That's not the bill.
That was the bill we just passed.
Truth is, Murkowski says she doesn't have a lot of answers yet.
Believe it or not, I haven't had a chance to actually read that bill. I have barely been in my office all day.
From what little she has seen, Murkowski says the bill would block Medicaid reimbursement to Planned Parenthood for a year. But that's not all.
Made it appear that it was not just to Planned Parenthood, but that it was other entities, was the words that were used, other entities that provide for women's health care. Well, what does that mean? I have no idea, but I don't like that. So yeah, I've got to look very, very critically at all of this.
The bill's changes to Medicaid expansion aren't easy to understand at a glance. After 2020, the bill would freeze enrollment and the government would begin paying states per capita based on how much they spent on the program last year. The New York Times reports Alaska would fare better than most other states. In Anchorage, North Rim Benefits Group President Joshua Weinstein advises employers on healthcare matters. He's learned enough about the bill to form at least one conclusion.
This legislation's much kinder to employers than it is to individuals who are purchasing health insurance on the marketplace or are getting Medicaid.
The bill does away with a lot of documentation for employers. Companies would no longer have to provide insurance if they have more than 50 workers. And Weinstein says it delays the so-called Cadillac tax on expensive plans until 2025.
This tax would have penalized the great majority of Alaskan employers that provide health insurance because the tax is based on the cost of health care, in short. And so that's a relief to see in the legislation.
But Weinstein says for individuals who buy their own insurance, the bill provides tax credits that are not as generous to Alaskans as the subsidies available now for plans on healthcare.gov. Murkowski says she's waiting for feedback from the Alaskans she's been working with on health care, like the state insurance commissioner, providers, and leaders in the Native health care system. Senator Dan Sullivan says he's not ready to discuss the health care bill either. He prides himself on reading bills in their entirety. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Department of Fish and Game announced today that all king salmon sport fisheries in the upper Copper River drainage will be closed this season due to declining salmon returns. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early found out that other closures will also be implemented in an effort to ensure enough fish make it upstream to spawn.
Fish and Game says the minimum amount of salmon the department wants for maintaining populations, or escapement, is 24,000 for the Copper River system, and the total run is only estimated at about 5,000 salmon above that. Mark Somerville is a biologist with the Upper Copper River.
Right now we've issued a preseason closure of all king salmon sport fisheries in the Upper Copper River, so that includes the Clutina and Gulcana. So at this moment, unless we see a significant increase or significant improvement of the run during the season that shows that we're exceeding our forecast, those fisheries will not open this year.
Somerville says limited closures aren't anything new, but this year's closures are much grander in scope.
We've seen downturns in king salmon populations across the state over the last 5 to 6 years, and there's been closures of king salmon fisheries in various areas of the state. This is the first time we've had to completely close the fishery here preseason, but we have had closures and restrictions since 2009.
Limits in fishing won't just be felt by sport fishermen this year. Somerville says there have been limits on subsistence fishermen. For the first time, there's a bag limit of only 2 king salmon for people fishing in the subsistence areas with fish wheels. And Chitna dip netters will not be allowed to retain any king salmon this summer. Additionally, efforts have been made to limit commercial harvest of king salmon.
What is done down in the Copper River to reduce the incidental harvest of king salmon during the sockeye fishery is the fleet is not allowed to fish within the Barrier Islands area, and it's called the king salmon closure area. And that's in those shallower waters, their gear is a little bit more effective at king salmon, so they're not allowed to fish within those areas. And secondly, their whole fishery is based on time and area, so the amount of time they'll be able to fish this year will be greatly reduced.
Somerville says those reductions may result in just 1 or 2 openers weekly. The state also issued closures or restrictions for areas in Juneau and Ketchikan. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska has 5 national monuments, public lands that are given special protections. And Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski doesn't want any more of the state added to that list. She reintroduced a congressional bill in January to limit the Antiquities Act, which gives the president the sweeping authority to make those designations. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports on who believes the state needs more protected lands and who doesn't.
In Barack Obama's last year in office, some wondered if the president would use the Antiquities Act to lock up offshore drilling leases in the Arctic Ocean. He wound up going about it a different way. But those types of land or water designations have some Alaska legislators worried.
It's clear the federal authorities are, to some degree, in my opinion, overreaching their ability.
That's Representative Dan Sadler, a House Republican from Eagle River. In a meeting at the Capitol on Thursday, legislators discussed a joint House resolution to back Senator Murkowski's congressional bill, essentially a letter of support to overhaul the Antiquities Act. The bill outlines that the president would need the approval of Congress and the state before creating a national monument. And the Alaska Department of Natural Resources thinks that's a good idea. Ed Fogles, a deputy commissioner with DNR, says the Antiquities Act was created over 100 years ago to protect sacred and cultural sites from things like grave robbing.
You know, we're seeing an expansion of that to where vast areas are put aside, and it may not be necessarily in the spirit of that intent.
In 1978, in a controversial decision, President Jimmy Carter created at least 11 national monuments. Congress later acted on a significant conservation bill that rolled some of those monuments into national parks. But the Antiquities Act gave Carter the authority to make that decision quickly. Eric Gaffey, an attorney with Earth Justice, thinks it's an important tool for a president to have.
Teddy Roosevelt to George W. Bush to Obama have used that to protect things ranging from large swaths of the ocean to the Statue of Liberty.
Gaffey says the Antiquities Act can still be used in the way it was intended, because important sacred and cultural sites have a new threat.
That's as relevant in Alaska as anywhere else, and maybe even more so because things are changing here because of climate change.
But Ed Fogles with the Department of Natural Resources says Alaska's current fiscal crisis is a reason to be concerned.
And our economy is primarily based on responsible natural resource development. So the less of that land there is, the less of a land base we have to work to do that with.
If Murkowski's bill makes it through Congress, it won't undo Alaska's existing national monuments, but it will create an extra step in the process and make it more difficult for the president to make sweeping designations. States like Utah are going a step further, urging President Donald Trump to overturn designations made under President Obama. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
Fairbanks and Anchorage will both get a big economic boost in May during a series of events to be held in conjunction with a major meeting of top diplomats from the eight Arctic Council member nations. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the Week of the Arctic will also enable the peoples of those nations to share their cultures.
Organizers say the Fairbanks Ministerial and other events to be held as part of the Week of the Arctic will attract about 1,000 participants and generate about $1 million in revenue.
So that's direct spending into the community. That doesn't include any multipliers or anything like that.
Deb Hickok is president and CEO of Explore Fairbanks, the local convention and tourism promotion agency. She says organizers are working on the many arrangements required for the Week of the Arctic to be held May 8th through 14th in both Fairbanks and Anchorage. And she says in addition to revenue, the ministerial will also bring a measure of prestige to Fairbanks because it's the highest profile Arctic Council event to be held here since the organization was founded 20 years ago.
Hopefully we'll build awareness as we get closer for the community to realize what a group we have here and what a privilege it is.
The ministerial is being held in Alaska because the biennial event is customarily conducted in a city within the nation that holds the council chairmanship. The event will mark the end of the United States' two-year chairmanship and the beginning of Finland's term. And it's an occasion for nations of the circumpolar north and member groups that represent indigenous peoples and other interests to share their knowledge and experience.
It'll be a good opportunity for us to examine how the Arctic has changed and how people around the world are responding to it. Learn some lessons from what they've done and teach them some of the things that we've discovered.
Larry Hinsman is Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's overseeing UAF's support for the ministerial and related Fairbanks area events.
For Fairbanks, it's just going to be a great economic boom. We'll have a lot of people coming in at a time when the tourist season hasn't quite swung up yet, and so we expect to fill the hotels and keep the taxis busy and fill the restaurants.
Hinsman talked about the Week of the Arctic during last week's Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce meeting. He was joined by Ann Masita, an Arctic Affairs officer with the U.S. State Department. Masita says the agency has sent a 40-member advance team to prepare for the ministerial in cooperation with local organizers and the Alaska Arctic Council Host Committee.
We're happy to be up here and look at the events and meet with partners, and everyone's been tremendously helpful in the lead-up to this, and we're looking forward to May.
Hinsman told the chamber audience that Week of the Arctic will begin in Fairbanks with events leading up to the May 11th ministerial. That's when the venue will switch to Anchorage for 3 days of a different series of events, collectively called North by North, that'll enable council member nations and indigenous peoples organizations to share their cultures.
The events in Fairbanks have a lot more of a scientific bent to them. The events in Anchorage have more of a arts and culture bent to them.
Most of the events not related to the ministerial will be open to the public. More information is available on the Arctic Council Host Committee website. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
When you open an REI catalog or page through Outside Magazine, what do you see? Do the people on the page look like you? Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk sat down with Reth Duer, an Arctic youth ambassador who's working to make that imagery more representative.
When you look at the depiction of what people go outside is, you know, it's usually like, you know, white people.
That's Reth Duer. He's a junior at the University of Alaska Anchorage and an Arctic youth ambassador.
When you look at these catalogs, you look at these Facebook ads, and when you go to REI, you don't see a lot of, you know, diversity of people. So I think it could be very tough for someone who's trying to, you know, explore the outdoors because there's not much commonality.
But Duer hasn't always been an outdoors enthusiast. His childhood was split between Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Omaha, Nebraska. Playing outside meant playing basketball or cops and robbers with his friends. As an 8-year-old, his mom told him a story that made him fear the outside world.
So I noticed it was like a wound on my mom's, like, the outside of her ankle, and her skin was just like completely different. And I was just like, hey, how did that happen? And my mom was just like, I was bitten by a snake. She became instantly like very sick, and I know she could have died that day.
Duerre had a different childhood than his parents. Before he was born, they fled East Africa because of political and religious oppression. And when he was 10 years old, his life and his parents' lives were about to become even more different. They were moving from Nebraska to Alaska.
Oh, I thought they were crazy when they first said that. I just knew Alaska, there was a lot of snow, it was very cold. And I knew about polar bears. You know, I just really had that picture of Ice Age. But just with people.
Landing in Anchorage, his new home, the first thing he saw was the Chugach Mountains. And for a kid from Nebraska, it was the first time he'd ever seen a mountain. At that moment, Duerre began thinking about starting to explore the outdoors. After graduating high school, he got that opportunity through a kayaking expedition in the Prince William Sound. And immediately...
Oh yeah, I was hooked for sure. They definitely had me hooked. They reeled me in.
Duerre found his calling.
A lot of people don't understand that this is like our public lands. It's for everyone. And I know I don't want to get rid of these misconceptions that, you know, the outdoors is for a particular audience. And, you know, there's different ways to, you know, explore and enjoy our outdoors. Whether that's, you know, going hiking, you know, backpacking, or, you know, going fishing with your family and friends.
He wants to help communities find ways to connect to the outdoors that work for them.
Our Alaska Native communities, you know, they live off the land, they live subsistently, and, you know, we have, you know, Hmong communities who like to go fishing, hooligan fishing. I think it's just really figuring out what the community needs are and how people enjoy their public lands and how they like to be outdoors, then, you know, creating a way for them to do that.
And he knows he's still learning.
This program has really opened my eyes of different things that are happening in the state of Alaska and why the voices, you know, of people in rural communities are important, and that their voices do matter and they should be at the table. And I want to be able to help with that experience.
Next year, Duerre will graduate with a degree in elementary education. He used to want to be a teacher in a big city like Chicago or Oakland, but he's changed his mind. He wants to work in rural Alaska and give back to the place he's called home for a decade. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Anchorage.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Manly, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zoe Sobel, Wesley Early and Annie Fite in Anchorage, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Craig, March 14th through the 16th at the Craig Tribal Association Hall, from 9 to 5, to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years, and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate, either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions, or call 800-478-1456, or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.